Okay, thank you all for coming. And before I start to talk, but that's a bit strange saying because I already started talking. But never mind. Here is a leaflet that is going around and you can get free information via email. So if you want to have that, fill in that form that is going around. Don't hold it back, but give the opportunity to others to complete the form. And then we can send you once a week some updates on the creation field. So now to the talk. Is there evidence for creation? And there you see two people fighting and pulling about evidence or facts. And they are thinking, one, it is evidence for evolution, and the other saying, no, it is evidence for creation. So we want to see here whether some of the information that we get is indeed evidence for creation rather than evolution. So probably you're thinking, what on earth are we going to listen to? Now, here's an outline. First of all, I want to talk with you about the question, creation, evolution, does it matter? And then the second is, I want to talk about geology and fossils, then a little bit about intelligent design, and then about variation and natural selection, and then come to some concluding remarks. So now you know what is coming and which part you may get to sleep because you're less interested in, and some parts where you want to be wide awake because you have a keen interest in that subject. Now, first of all, when we talk about creation evolution, what are we talking about? So one thing is on the left, you see evolution. And you see that at the bottom, A, that there's a line is connecting everything. So in other words, evolution says that all organisms and plants are somehow or another connected to each other. Or put in other words, all the organisms are descended from a common ancestor. Now the creation model on the right hand side for you, B, shows that there is some variation possible, but you see that all those forms like the peacock, the duck, and the cat, and the rabbit, and the horse, they are not connected in any way. So it means that they have multiple origins. And there is some variation possible, and you can see if you look around yourself that there's an enormous variation already existing within us human beings. Isn't it remarkable that we can recognize out of the billions of people around, our husband, our children, our friends? There's enormous variability there. So that are the two different perspectives. Everything is related to each other ultimately, or there are some cases where there's absolutely no connection between the different organisms. So it is not the case that the cat and the peacock are descended from the same common ancestor. Now this fits actually, this pattern, the right pattern, with Genesis 1, verse 21. And there it says, so God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it according to their kinds. So you could say that is the cat kind, the peacock kind, the duck kind. And every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So no common ancestry, but separate creations. That is what we are discussing here. But first of all, why bother about this question? Is the question of creation or evolution really important? Now, of course, we all know that ultimately it is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ that is important for our salvation. But this question is, of course, also a fundamental question. And it is holding many people back from becoming a Christian. So if we look at evolution, then we know that all the organisms are descended from a common ancestor. So that must have involved a lot of death occurring over the generations to come to us human beings. So evolution works with the process of death. Now if we think about creation, it is the other way around. There was no death involved, but we were created. And because of sin going the wrong way, death came into being. So here you see the big difference. One is death leading to evolution and progress, as it is called, and the other saying, no, death is actually the consequence of sin and leads to deterioration ultimately. Except, of course, we know that our own death is something that we are not looking forward to. 1 Corinthians 15 verse 26 says that the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And that is a hope that a Christian has. Now let us now look at the idea that some people have that God used evolution. And then at some stage in the process of evolution, God, as it were, gave a soul to Adam and Eve. Now here you see two families, and something happens, something very remarkable in this scenario happens to these families. Because in two of those people, you see on the left-hand side, in the boy, a soul was imparted, and on the right-hand side, in the girl, the soul was imparted. And what those people then say is that those people are Adam and Eve. So now that raises, of course, some interesting questions. There we have Adam and Eve. So what question is there, for instance? What were their parents? And what were their brothers and sisters? What were they? Were they not humans? Or were they perhaps humans? But then, what does it mean then? And could it be that their parents could sin? Or could they not? So we have here an enormous puzzle that suddenly the parents of Adam and the parents of Eve were not humans, but Adam and Eve were humans with a moral conscience that their parents and their brothers and sisters apparently did not have. And that is a really big problem, I find, with the idea of theistic evolution. And that is the idea that God used evolution to ultimately get to mankind, to what we are. Now, another very important one, and I heard years ago in 2009, the Darwin year, a Dutch professor saying to me, I believe in the theistic evolution, but this text of Romans 5 causes me enormous trouble. And we will read it, and you can see where the trouble is. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man. So sin entered the world through one man. And death through sin. And this way, death came to all people because all sinned. To be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as Adam did, who is a pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass. For if the many died, that is all of us as well, by the trespass of the one man, and that is Adam, and not multiple men, we all died by the trespass of the one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift came by the grace of the one man? And that is, of course, Jesus Christ. And this comparison only makes sense when we realize that it is comparing one man with another man, and not multiple men with one man. Then the comparison falls away. It is quite strongly written here that Paul writes it was because of the sin of one man that all suffer death. But it is by the grace of one man that all have the opportunity for eternal life. So that is Jesus Christ, overflow to the many. And that is what essentially is the importance of the gospel and of the creation story. That only when we believe that, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ makes sense. So the question is then, also when we think about ourselves, who is our ancestor? Is it Adam or an ape-like ancestor? Now if it is Adam, then we also believe that we are here with a purpose, that we are planned, that we are wanted, that we are desired by God, because he had in his mind to create us. And that gives enormous value. But it also means that God sets the rules of life. So the moral compass is what God writes in his word. Now if we are descended from an ape, essentially there is no set for any moral compass. Because who sets the moral compass? Who tells what is right and what is wrong? And perhaps you have heard of the Nuremberg trials. There Hermann Göring stalled at some moment. For those who don't know who Hermann Göring is, he is the second in command. He was in the Third Reich, in the Second World War. And he was not a stupid man. He was a very clever man. And he was sitting there in the Nuremberg trials. And he told the accusers, the prosecutors, look, I did everything right according to the German law at that time. I did nothing wrong. The German law applied to me because I lived in Germany. So who are you that you tell me that I am wrong? Who are you that you set the rules? And the whole court came to a standstill. And what I read, they had to consult and think about it. And of course we all know that there is right and wrong. And I believe that even Göring deep in his heart knew what was right and wrong. Because we are all created, whether we want it or not, with a conscience. And that conscience is, in a sense, the rule of God. And of course you can harden your heart, you can stump yourself off and make your blunt and not have a sense anymore of good and right, but deep within you, you definitely know what is good and right. So they came to the conclusion, there is a lawgiver, and that is the God of the Bible, who sets the rules. Now if you don't believe in those rules, and you believe that you come from evolution, that is what you there see at the basis, then you can say, anything is possible, because who sets the rules? Pornography is just fine. And what I hear students very often say when I talk about marriage with them in passing, I say, do you want to marry? And I said, yes. And what do you think of divorce? Oh yeah, if it doesn't fit me, I can always divorce. And what I tell them, look, if that is your starting point, you should not marry. Because the decision you take at that moment is a fundamental decision. You make a decision for life. But if you don't believe in the Bible, if you don't believe in creation, and that God created us man and woman to become united and become one flesh, what foundation do you have to make the rules? Anything is allowed. Homosexual behavior is allowed, LGBTQ is allowed, abortion up till birth, as we now see in the United Kingdom, is allowed. With that foundation of evolution, anything is permissible. Even, as Göring rightly said, killing Jews and gypsies. Now, if we have a creation as the basis, and we are created and wanted, then the perspective changes enormously. And you can see what happens very often in our present day world is that creation is attacked. The foundation of our belief system is attacked. Whereas we as creationists, we are attacking the symptoms of the wrong foundation. But we are not attacking the foundation. And that is the thing what we need to do. You see that at the top, many Christians, and I at times I think the same, I'm just relaxing because life is so nice and God is blessing me. Doing nothing. Well, you have the weapons, as God gave, read Ephesians, to fight. And some, as you see there, the brown guy on the right, is shooting at the foundation. How many Christians are shooting their own foundation? And some are shooting the symptoms and some shoot just randomly. But you see the opposition is very clear in what the foundation of Christianity is and of human life is, and to fail you. So evolution or creation, does it matter? And here we see one important thing that is the hope of a Christian that humanists don't have. For God so loved you that he gave his only begotten son so that if you believe in him, you will not perish, but you will have eternal life. And believing is not just like believing that he is a piece of wood, but it is going further. If you give your life to him, if you trust him in all you do, then you will have eternal life. And this is a fundamental message that we have as Christians, an incredible message of hope for everybody. There's hope, there's a future. But here you see an atheist saying in 1982, those Christians who regard the creation stories as myth or allegories are undermining the rest of scripture. For if there was no Adam, there was no fall. And if there was no fall, there was no hell. And if there was no hell, there was no need of Jesus as second Adam and incarnate Savior, crucified and risen. This man saw it very sharp that if he can destroy that idea of creation, we essentially make the foundation of creation, of Christianity disappear and make Christianity meaningless. He thus says, that is his conclusion, evolution thus becomes the most potent weapon for destroying the Christian faith. That is a thing to ponder. So that is why I think this question is really important. Are you created with a plan and a purpose by loving God? Or are we arriving here at random with no purpose, just empty? So now let's look, because the story can be nice, but is there any evidence to support this story, this fundament, as it were, the fundament of creation? We have all heard of fossils and layers that are being deposited and take millions of years to form. At least that is what secular geology says. But in the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980, that is in northwest United States, an enormous eruption, many layers were formed. And here you see an example. In some cases, 140 meters of deposits were formed in just a few hours. And here you see an enormous pile of layers that were just formed in a few hours. You can see the size compared to the man that is there. So those layers don't need to take millions of years to form. They can just form when the conditions are catastrophic in a few hours. Now if you think about this, and when I discussed with some geologists in the 90s, they didn't even know about this phenomenon, that is polystrate fossils, that are fossils that penetrate many layers. And here you see a tree that is penetrating many layers. And you can imagine that if that was really taking millions of years, it beggars belief that that tree would continue to persist for millions of years in that position and that the layers would just lay around it in millions of years. That indicates a rapid deposition and a rapid formation of fossils. Now here I found something myself in Key West in Florida. You see a piece of wood. It's really a piece of wood and a piece of stone or stone-like material. And that must have, of course, formed rather rapidly. And when you think about those things, then you can think about the flood that is described, Noah's flood, in Genesis chapter 7 and 8, where enormous catastrophe occurred with enormous amounts of water coming from the rain, coming from the under the earth, uprising, probably earthquakes as well, and I don't know what, but they caused enormous flows of water that have enormous strength, as we see in that middle picture, where deposits are formed, enormous thick layers in just a few hours. Now let's now look at some textbook fossils or sequence of fossils and evolution. So on the left we have a supposed evolution of the whale, and on the right we have the supposed evolution of the horse. Now when you see those pictures, one thing I find already remarkable, and that is this phenomenon. It took allegedly 55 million years to get from a land animal to the present day whales. That is an enormous change in 55 million years. That is flabbergasting. You have a land animal with four legs being transformed not just in one type of whale, but toothed whales and also baleen whales. Enormous variety in just 55 million years. On the other side, you have, compared to that, a minor change in the horse, because it stays a land animal, and it is largely, you could argue, there's more than that, but you could argue an increase in size. But also that took 55 million years. So the rate of evolution, if evolution occurred, is incredibly faster in the whale than in the horse. Now that I find flabbergasting, that you can get such an enormous variety in 55 million years on the one hand, and such little variety, if you wish, in the evolution of the horse on the other hand. Now let's now look at some more details. So we have there a nice sequence at the left-hand side, and you see there a red arch. And those organisms that you see there, the Pachycetus until the Rodhocetus, they were all living simultaneously according to Fossil Works. That is a website where all the known fossils are recorded. So they lived at the same time. So they were not evolving one from the other, but they concomitantly occurred. So that is already a thing. Did it occur, that evolution? Or were they just coexisting? Now for the creation model, there's no problem, because God created them and they would coexist. Now let's now look at the horse. One thing I find fascinating, and I unfortunately forgot where I found this information, but because I did an extensive discussion in the 90s and then I collected that information and wrote it down somewhere. But if you look at the number of ribs, so the oldest ancestor of the horse had 18 ribs. The next one had 15. Then the following one had 19, and then the present horse has 18. So there's a variation in rib number going up and down and up again, a rather peculiar sort of evolution and change. Now the other big step is going from water animals to land animals. Of course the whale was going from land to water, but a very important step in evolution is going from water animals to land animals. And I think in 2005 this organism was found, a fossil, Tiktaalik they called it, and they said it is an intermediate between the land animals and the water animals. And they found even some tracks that suggested that maybe those animals were able to walk. Now let's now look what the picture says. So here is a model that I took from a website and also a scientific article. And there you see a nice sequence from the bottom, Oestenopteron, that is a fish, to the top, Ichthyostega, and that Ichthyostega is considered to be the first quadruped or land animal. And you see Tiktaalik is nicely in between. Now, when you look at the age of those fossils according to the theory of evolution, and I got those data again from Fossil Works and from Britannica Encyclopedia. So there you see, 370 million years ago, there was Oestenopteron. That is supposedly the ancestor of all. But if you see the other animals, they lived 382 to 384 million years ago. So in other words, they lived before the Oestenopteron. So let's now look and rearrange the things in the sequence they really appeared, according to even the own records of Fossil Works and the Britannica Encyclopedia. There you see, Oestenopteron is actually the youngest one, and not the oldest one. And in layers below that, so older, we find the Ichthyostega. And below that, we find the Acanthostega. And then we find the Tiktaalik. And then under that, we find the Pandrichthyus. Now let's compare that again with what the model says. You see, the ancestor, the Austenopteron, on the right-hand side, that was the ancestor, supposedly, of the land animals, occurred much earlier, as we can see on the left, in the fossil record, than all the so-called descendants. It should have been the way it is depicted on the right, but in fact, if you arrange it according to the data that the evolution is ascribed to it, you get a completely different picture. The ancestor of all those forms actually preceded the descendants. And that is a bit strange. That is the same as saying your grandparents lived after their grandchildren. That is a bit odd, isn't it? So the Tiktaalik lived in between the first tetrapod and the fish ancestor, but lived before the fish-like ancestor. And that is a bit peculiar. Now another famous example is the Archaeopteryx. And the Archaeopteryx is considered to be an intermediate between the dinosaurs and the birds. And here you see the age of those animals or fossils is 150 to 125 million years ago. But in 1985, a paper came out, and there we see Proto-Avis, and that is 221 to 205 million years old. So that is at least 50 million years older than the ancestor. So a bird-like animal was living, or a bird was living, before the ancestor of the birds. A similar story. Now there's much more to say about the Archaeopteryx, but I don't want to go into detail there. But the point is that the grandchildren apparently lived before the grandparents, when you look at the dates that even evolutionists give to the fossils. Now another one big thing that happened is the Cambrian explosion. And here you see an example from the National Geographic and what they say when life got complicated. And let's see what they say in the small print. How did life explode from simple microbes to complex creatures? And then it says here, even they are flabbergasted themselves, not once, but twice. Scientists see clues. And that is really problematic. It is already a miracle, if you wish to use the word, that life arrives, or that a complicated life form arrives. But here it says, no, it didn't happen once, but it happened at least twice. And here you have a picture out of their paper. And you see there on the right-hand side, the bottom, you see those lines, the phylum, the phylum, the phylum. And it looks as if there are no connections between those phylums. And that makes me think incredibly much about the picture I showed earlier. It looks much more like the thing we see on the right-hand side than the thing that we see on the left-hand side. And I would say, therefore, that is evidence. I never use the word proof. I always tell my students, you never can prove something in science. You can only find evidence or reject your hypothesis. So this is evidence for the picture B rather than picture A. Because picture B said there would be separate phylums, if you wish. That's what the word they used. Rather than a connection between all the phylums. Now this is not a strange idea, because Stephen Jay Gould, he was a very famous paleontologist, and he said all paleontologists know that the fossil record contained precious little in the way of intermediate forms. That's what a very prominent man said. He died in 2001. Transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt. So in other words, there are enormous gaps between different groups, between major groups. And this Mr. Denton, he said more recently, I think 2015, he wrote this bit, despite the discovery of a huge number of new fossil forms, it is still overwhelmingly true, as Darwin confessed 150 years ago, the distinction of specific forms and they're not being blended together by innumerable transitional links is a very obvious difficulty. That is what Darwin himself said as well. It is as if there are gaps at crucial moments, distinctions between types at crucial moments. And again, I want to emphasize, this is what God said, or what Genesis 1 says. So God created the great creatures according to their kinds. And that is exactly what those people, they don't believe themselves in creation, but essentially say at the major transitions, where you would expect major transitions, fossils are not there. And even after 150 years searching, the fossils have not been found. So this is really suggesting to me that they are not there. I can't say I can prove that they are not there, because something that is not there may be found. But so far, the indication is that they are just not there. And some people even say that the more we search, the more complex the situation becomes for the evolutionary model. Now, of course, we are particularly interested in ourselves. Where do I come from? Where do we come from? And you have all those programs on TV and asking, who are my ancestors? And then some find very bad things of their ancestors, and some are jubilant because they find there was a famous and good-doing person in their ancestry. So here we have the March of Progress, and I think this was published in 65, is what I wanted to say. And there you have those sort of intermediate forms that lead to man, present-day man. And what you notice, it is from stooping, straight up, but it's very dubious whether some of those really actually stood more or less straight up. And this is a man in whose department I worked in 1994. He was then head of department in the University of Liverpool, but I don't know much about him. But he then went to Washington, and there he wrote, on the left of the picture, there's an ape. On the right, there's a man. And between the two is a succession of figures that become ever more human-like. And our progress from ape to human looks so smooth, so tidy. And it is such a beguiling image that even the experts are loath to let it go. But it is an illusion. And this man knows what he talks about, because he was one of the people who worked with Leakey and all those people, and found also Lucy. So he is still, he's now in his 80s, one of the most famous paleontologists, human paleontologists or anthropologists, alive at present. And I noticed this year he even still published research papers about this subject. Now, one thing that was very remarkable, that were the Laetoli footprints, and they were found, I believe, I forgot the date, but I think it was in the 70s. Now, what you see there at the top are the Laetoli footprints. So that are in Tanzania footprints that they found in a layer of sediment. And they were looking at them. And then Mr. Tuttle, who did an exploration in 1990, he said, look, if the footprints were not so old, we would readily conclude that they were made by a member of our genus, Homo. So in other words, he says, they look like man. And if age was not a problem, the antiquity of those footprints, or supposed antiquity of those footprints, we would all have concluded it were human footprints. But because humans, according to the theory of evolution, were not around at that time, it can't be human. So rather than thinking, perhaps they are human, they said, no, because of the age of the fossil, according to the theory of evolution, they can't be human. And then he says, consider that some footprints were larger than 25 centimeters, as larger than my feet, I measured them up, where Lucy was not taller than about this. So can you imagine a person like that with feet like me? So that also is an idea that those feet are far too large for Lucy. And then if you look at the footprints there, the Laetoli print and the human foot, they look very much like each other. And some people say, if I had found them on the beach, I would have said they are human prints. If you look at the chimp or the footprints of Lucy, then that would be a similar thing as the chimp. Then that doesn't fit at all with the human footprint or the footprint in Laetoli. So here is a suggestion that humans lived already that long ago in evolutionary terms, rather than not. And more recently, but I found this paper a little bit dubious. I know Sanford and others say this is another thing indicating humans lived even 5.7 million years ago. But when I looked at the size of the footprints in the paper, they were just 4 or 5 centimeters. And that looks to me incredibly small. That is about this. And I think children with such small feet, they are not able to walk. So I'm a bit dubious about that paper. But at least they suggest in their paper that it is. And it is actually in a very good journal, one of the most high-ranking journals in the scientific world, published as perhaps human footprints. So the footprints are too big, and it looks like those from a man. And the Gierlinski paper, even older footprints are found. So couldn't it be that those footprints are indeed footprints of men? And this is not an isolated instance, because here you have a nice overview written in a book by Roop and Sanford, Contested Bones. And there you see at the top, the blue line, Homo, or sapiens, or human, and on the bottom, you see the age, present to about 6 million years ago. So according to the theory of evolution, the age of human fossils ranges from about 5.5 million years ago to present. The supposed ancestors you see there, ape Australopithecus, southern ape, the supposed ancestors of human beings, they have fossils of 4.5 to about 1.2 million years ago. So you see, even evolutionists say they are coexisting organisms. It is not the case that Lucy was the ancestor of present-day humans, but they coexisted. And it is fascinating when you read the papers by Johansson in 1973, when he found Lucy, that he said, we found a lot of hominid bones, or homo bones. So they even write in the original paper that human and ape bones, Australopithecus, southern ape is what it means, were co-occurring. And Roop and Sanford even write in their book that, and also Werner in another book series about human evolution published in 2024, write that in so many cases those bones were found together that no wonder you can get a sort of apparently transitional forms generated. So now Darwin wrote something, I get cold shivers. And he says that the abrupt manner in which whole groups of species suddenly appear in certain formations, that is, for instance, the complex development, what the National Geographic paper said, of all sorts of complex life forms. They all of a sudden appear. And also Goldsetter, at important places where you would expect transitional forms, there was rather a sudden appearance of a new form. He says, if numerous species belonging to the same genera or families have really started into life at once, that fact would be fatal to the theory of evolution through natural selection. So he says those things that we just discussed are effectively fatal for the theory of evolution. Another and allied difficulty, which is much more serious, the manner in which species of the main divisions of the animal kingdom suddenly appear in the lowest known fossiliferous rocks. And the case at present must remain inexplicable and may be truly urged as a valid argument against the views here entertained. And that are the words of Darwin in his book, The Origin of Species or The Survival of Favored Races. That is the subtitle of the book. So what do we conclude from here? from the fossils that there is a systematic lack of intermediate forms, that there are fossils in the wrong order according to the theory of evolution, that the supposed evolution shows strange patterns and shows large variations in evolutionary rates. Think about the incredible change in the whale in 55 million years and the relatively small change in the horse in 55 million years. So what this man concludes, Denton, fossils are no proof of common descent, but fit the pattern of typology. And that is a difficult way of saying it fit the pattern of being created according to its kind. He didn't use that term because he doesn't believe in creation. Now, another aspect is, of course, our God is incredibly intelligent. He's incredibly powerful and he's omniscient. And he could make things that are irreducibly complex. And that is what Bayes says. It is something that cannot be produced directly by slight successive modifications of a precursor system, because any precursors to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional. There's a lot of words to get around, but let us give some examples. So William Paley, for instance, says, let's say we walk here in the hills and we find a watch somewhere on the path. And immediately, our idea is this has been made by something intelligent, because it has a purpose and it has intricate systems, cogs and wheels that work together to make it work. We take one cog out and the watch doesn't work anymore. So that is an irreducibly complex system, the watch. Now, in animal life, you have that as well. For instance, the bombardier beetle, where several substances are coming together when the animal is attacked or when it feels threatened in a combustion chamber, and suddenly leads to an explosion that is directed to the enemy. Now you can imagine, if something is wrong, for instance the exit was not there, then the animal itself would explode. So here we have also an irreducibly complex system. And those that suffer from mice at home, they use also an irreducibly complex system. A simple thing like a mousetrap. Take one thing out and the mousetrap does not work. All the parts have to come together at the same time, not subsequently, gradually, but at the same time to make it work. Without the wooden base plate, you will have no mousetrap. Now the next bit is variation and natural selection, because the mechanism, probably you've heard that several times over the TV when David Attenborough was talking about evolution and natural selection made it possible, as if natural selection, incidentally, is like God. It can make anything possible. Now here Dawkins writes, artificial selection, so that is what breeders do with plants and doves and dogs, as you see here, is not just an analogy of natural selection. It is an experimental rather than observational test of the hypothesis that selection causes evolutionary change. So he says experimental selection or artificial selection is a nice experiment to show natural selection, because we now act, you could say, as an artificial natural selection by selecting the animals or the plants that we like. Now, incidentally, there's nothing to do with the talk, but I find it interesting to say, this book I got from a scientific journal called International Journal of Obesity. And I got a letter from the editors as well, and it said, thank you for your services to our journal, and as a matter of appreciation, we give you this book. And we hope that you will use it to battle those stupid ideas of creation. That was what the text wrote. And I thought that is fascinating. Actually, and Richard Dawkins, I like his writing style. I read the book with great interest, and he knows a lot, so there's nothing wrong with that. But the interpretation of the data, as we discuss here, is different from the interpretation that I have. And you can see that some of those things that were said about the sequence of fossils, when you look at the actual dates that the fossils occurred, the pattern suddenly changes and doesn't fit. And even when you then read specialists in geology, paleontology, anthropology, then they say, actually, the data are not so solid in support for evolution. So here is how natural selection then works. So rather than us wanting giraffes with longer necks, the giraffes themselves, they got at the top right. Let's look at Darwin's explanation. You see there's three giraffes. Now one has a longer neck than the other two, and one of the one with the shorter neck dies, and the longer necked one gets offspring. So the offspring have longer necks, and those with the longer necks, they will again get offspring to get even longer necks. So you can go to ad infinitum to get enormously long necks. But one thing you realize with artificial selection, and remember, Dawkins said it is an experimental model, is that no matter how stringent we select, the duff stays a duff and the dog stays a dog. The dog will never become a cat and the duff will never become a parakeet or an eagle. There is a limit to the possible variation. And you remember the creation model where you had those stems and you saw that there was some variation possible and that is created in. And as I said before, look at ourselves. We have enormous variation in our appearance and I'm glad we have and that we are not all the same. Now then the Darwin finches. People often say this was really what led Darwin to think about his theory of evolution by natural selection. And you see here all those finches on the different islands of the Galapagos Islands having different beaks. And these two people, Peter and Rosemary Grant, they did for decades research on the Darwin finches. And they found something really remarkable. They found here, let us start at the left, there was a dry year, 1977. And what you see that the back depth, that is indicated at the top, what is meant with the back depth, was increased. So when they first saw that, they said, here we have evolution in action. You see the beak becomes bigger and bigger. But then, next years, the beak size decreased. And then there was a dry year again, and the beak size increased. But then it passed, and the beak size decreased. So what is happening there? The beak size showed oscillations, depending on what was needed. So a bigger beak, when things are dry, of course you can eat harder nuts. And that is very handy. So in the dry moments, where the nuts are harder to crack, a big beak helps, and those with a smaller beak were not so much able to do it, and they would die. But then, when the dry year ended, the normal beaks returned, and it was never the case that was an ever-increasing size in the depth of the beak. Now, natural selection alone is not enough, because natural selection, as the word says, selects. So you have to have something to select from. So you need new information. And the neo-Darwinist said mutation of genetic material is the new information. And here you see the mutation rate is about 1.1 to 1.7 times 10 to the minus 8 per nucleotide. Now, in other words, every baby has around 100 new mutations. So that is quite a bit, of course, compared to the 3 billion base pairs is almost nothing, but every baby has 100 new mutations. But the problem is, few, if any at all, of those mutations are positive. The bulk of those mutations are detrimental. Think about all the genetic diseases that we see around us. They are mutations from an initially perfect genetic code. And a large number of directed sequential mutations are required to climb Mount Improbable. So if you want to come from a land-dwelling animal to a whale, you have to have a whole host, enormous number of mutations to change your forelegs to flippers and to change your nostrils here to the back of your head. Change all the transport channels of air, because it's not only that then your lungs are changed, but also your channels of air have to be transformed enormously. You have an enormous change of the design of the whole organism. And that must come from sequential mutations that slowly built it up. It's just impossible. Another reason that this is very unlikely to occur is what you see on the left. DNA is continuously subject to mutation. That is a fact of life. And it says that it is the raw material of evolution. But the problem is, if there are too many mutations in one go, like, for instance, when we are in Chernobyl in 1986, or Hiroshima, then you have a lot of radiation, enormous numbers of mutations induced, rather than leading to improvement, it leads to deterioration. So it needs mutation, but it can't be too rapid, because then it destroys evolution. And then you say, to sustain life, the mutations therefore must be repaired. And of course, if you repair the mutations, then you counteract any evolution that can occur. And when you think about repair, that can only occur when you have an intact system. If your repair mechanism is not perfect, then you will not be able to sustain life. And at the bottom, a system cannot be generated from new. Now, the significance of repair, in 2005 already, there were 150 DNA repair genes known. So in your cell, there are 150 DNA repair genes at work right now. And every day, each cell of you is exposed to about 50,000 mutation events. So that is quite a lot. Each cell, 50,000 mutation events a day. And they are all, almost all repaired by this very effective DNA repair system. Now, mutations lead to disease. But at the top, some people say that is an example of evolution, because when you are in a cave, the fish at the top is a cavefish, you don't need eyes. And what is happening? Those fish don't have eyes. But that is a loss of eyes. It is not creating new eyes. It is not creating a new organ or organ system. You are losing an organ or organ system. So in other words, that fish, you could argue, is degenerated rather than evolved. And then you have sickle cell anemia. That is also very often used as an example of evolution at work. And sickle cells, when you're heterozygous, when you have a healthy gene and an unhealthy gene, protects you for malaria. But the problem is, in a place like here where malaria is not existent, or barely existent, it comes with all sorts of complications that you see on the right-hand side. It reduces your quality of life. So in other words, rather than a beneficial mutation and leading to an improvement, it leads to deterioration. So here, the example is in sickle cell, that the deterioration of the genetic material coincidentally led to an improvement in living chances in places where you have malaria. So here, Genesis 3, verse 17 to 18, it says, to Adam he said, because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I command you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it. All the days of your life it will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. Now, this then means that before that, thorns and thistles were not growing. So in other words, nature became degenerate. It degenerated rather than improved with the fall. So variation then, the conclusion there is, artificial selection always reaches a limit. Oscillating adaptation, so big increase, big decrease, big increase, big decrease, but no progressive change. There are no positive and directed sequential mutations. And mutations lead to degenerations. And an impressive mutation protection mechanism. So variation is limited, and this indicates that higher taxonomic rounds, so as animal and plant types like roses or cats or dogs, are delineated by clear-cut borders. Concluding remarks. And now you think you're almost there, but this will take some time as well, because I want to show you what happens in society as well, with some thoughts that we as Christians may have. So you hear the conclusion from what I said so far. Intermediate forms are systematically missing. So we have created according to the kinds. The data support that, in my view. The fossils are in the wrong order, as I indicated, when I moved all the animals around according to the fossil ages. Organs and organ systems suggest intelligent design. Think about the mousetrap. Variation is limited. Think about artificial selection. Doves stay doves, and as a Dutchman I would say tulips stay tulips. And life forms are stable within borders, and there's evidence for intelligent design with the possibility of rapid adaptations to a changing environment, but within limits. So think about the fish that lost the eyes. Now one question. I found this rather funny, I must say. All this in 6 days? Yep. Are you sure it is 6 days? Yes, 6 days. God created the universe in 6 days. Yes, the Bible says 6 days. Six regular earth-rotating days. Yes, six normal days. Wow, that's amazing. 6 days. Yes, 6 days. Don't those 6 days of creation make you wonder? Wonder about what? I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but I did think about that as well. Why did God take so long? And there's an important question point next to it. God could have created the universe in no time at all. He would have been able to do that. Since he's all powerful, he took 6 days to create and rested on the seventh day, not because he's weak, but so we have a week. So he sets an example for us that we should work at most 6 days and then rest on the seventh days. Incidentally, Napoleon tried a 10-day week and it destroyed human beings. We became utterly exhausted. And we see very many people, and I had myself also talked with my wife, that at times I was probably working too hard, also working on Sundays, but it is not a good thing. I think it is a good principle to keep 1 day a week really free from work and focus on our family and also, of course, on our God and develop that relationship with Him. So we showed this picture and we said we have two foundations. The humanists and the atheist says evolution. And the creationist says, or the Christian says, no, it is creation. And what you see here, what we should do, is we should think about attacking that foundation. Because that foundation leads to all the balloons. And of course, we should not entirely ignore all those things, because abortion till birth is an abomination in my eyes. And I'm flabbergasted that the parliament voted for it. I can't believe it. And I said to my wife, I can't imagine the midwife or the surgeon or the gynecologist standing there just, let's say, 1 second before birth to kill that baby. I can't imagine. How can you do that? How can you do that? I can't imagine it. And yet, apparently, there are people who are prepared and willing to do this. So we must think about evolution and attack evolution. And see that we have a value of life and that we are wanted, that we are wished. Now, one of the biggest problems in universities, and this is a study I think that CMI did, but here's another study that did it as well, where they looked at students going to university. And they looked at the number of Christian students that were at the end of the student period still Christians. So they came in as a Christian, and only 50% came out as a Christian. And of the atheist students, about 100% of the atheist students that came in came out as atheist. So of course you have occasionally a conversion of an atheist to Christianity, but for all intents and purposes, atheists stay atheist in university, but Christians lose their faith. And recently I saw a report by the Humanist Society where they said that 57% of their members had a Christian upbringing. So somewhere we go wrong. And what is the problem? Here you see, influenced by evolution in the loss of faith than by any other thing. So chemical evolution and natural selection, 65% or 66%, was the reason for them to abandon their faith. And that is, of course, what you are bombarded with, particularly when you study biology or chemistry, that evolution is how life arose and everything we see around us. And we need to know as Christians, particularly as younger Christians, that we have a reason. And Peter says that as well. Be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have to everyone who asks you for that reason. And that means reasoning. If you read Acts 16 to 19, I was struck by the fact that there you see so many times that Paul, as usual, was reasoning in the synagogue, was arguing, was convincing, was all those sorts of words that show the ratio at work. And of course, we are a combination. We are a unity of also our mind. Serve the Lord with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. So Christianity is not mindless, but it is mindful, full of mind, full of thinking. Now this is another aspect that I checked whether this was updated, but it is not. Council of Europe 2007, it says for some people the creation as a matter of religious belief gives a meaning to life. Nevertheless, the Parliamentary Assembly is worried about the possible ill effects of the spread of creationist ideas within our education system and about the consequences for our democracy. I don't know how they see that danger, but that is what they say. If we are not careful, creationism could become a threat to human life. And I hope I have shown you that it is rather the opposite, that if you have the other foundation, then anything is permissible and allowable. But when you believe in creation, that we are here with a purpose, and that God gave the moral standard in the Bible, then you see that we are all valuable people, and that applies incidentally also to any LGBT plus person and any atheist. So we always should, I don't know who said it, but we should always look at the other person, that Jesus Christ, no matter what his views are, and no matter his or her aggression, that Jesus Christ died for that person. And that is the thing I have to learn myself as well. Because sometimes I can be so filled with anger. And maybe that's righteous anger, because God was sometimes very angry as well. But at the same time, we have to respect the other person. So, does it matter, coming back to it? And here we have Dawkins saying, in the universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. That is important to emphasize. Nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. And that is something that is incredibly sad. And I like John Lennox when he said, when he was asked the question, when we think about Christianity, we think also very often about judgment. And we think about something as being very negative. But let's turn it around, he said. Suppose your daughter, and it's very apt now when we hear of the grooming raping gang report. Suppose that your daughter or you yourself were raped or sexually mistreated. And then you see that the person who did it isn't judged or isn't prosecuted. It feels unfair. And people could also say Adolf Hitler, he shot himself. He escaped his rightful judgment. But that judgment will come. Not now, but later. Everybody, also we as Christians, are responsible for the things that we do. And that is not something out of the blue, but here it is clearly said in Revelations. And then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. The earth and the heavens fled from his presence and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. And books were opened. And the good news is, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according what they had done as recorded in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And each person was judged according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown in the lake of fire. And the lake of fire is in the second death. And anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown in the lake of fire. So the question is your name written in the book of life? And how can your name be written in the book of life? How can that be? That can be because of the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, because he did see that all of us have sinned and all of us fall short of the standards of God. And he was so in love with us that he thought, I don't want, as Peter says as well, I don't want, and Ezekiel writes as well, that anyone gets lost. Do you think, Ezekiel writes, that I have pleasure in the death of a man? No, I don't have pleasure in the death of a man, but I have pleasure in the salvation. And do you know how much pleasure I have? That I am prepared to suffer the most cruel death on earth for me, for you. So much he loved us, so much he longed for us to turn to him, to escape that judgment before the white throne. That is the offer we have. And that is where I want to end my talk. And maybe it gives food for thought. But one final thing. It's maybe a bit of deflation after what I just talked about. But maybe you are interested in being able to defend creation. But also to rationally defend your faith. And not stand there with a mouth full of tooth only. But be able to give an answer of the hope that you have to anyone who asks for it. And the Creation magazine can enormously help you for that. And Lucien is at the back. Maybe you can stand up so people know who you are. He is at the tables there, and he is happy to provide you with a subscription to the Creation magazine.
And gifts.
And I just want to thank you all for your attention. And if there are questions, speak loud because I'm a little bit hard of hearing.